Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Charles Yu read his story Fable from the May 30th, 2016 issue of the magazine. Yu is the author of two story collections and one novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. This is his first story in the magazine. Now here's Charles Yu.
Fable. Once upon a time, there was a man whose therapist thought it would be a good idea for the man to work through some stuff by telling a story about that stuff. The man lived in a one-bedroom efficiency cottage all by himself in a sort of dicey part of town. One day, the man woke up and realized that this was pretty much it for him. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great either, and not likely to improve. The man was smart enough to realize this, yet not quite smart enough to do anything about it. He lived out the rest of his days and eventually died. The end. Happy now? The man could see that his therapist was not amused. A rather unsatisfactory ending, the therapist opined, and suggested that the man could do better. The man thought, is she really serious about this? But he didn't say anything out loud. The man was not convinced that he needed to be talking to the therapist at all, but he had tried so many other things, potions, spells, witches, and spent so much of his copper and silver with absolutely nothing to show for it, that he figured, why the hell not? So, how do I do this? He asked. Why don't you start again? The therapist replied, and instead of rushing to the end, try to focus on the details. Okay, the man said. Once upon a time, there was a man who did not know how to use a sword, and was also very afraid of dragons. So he took the LSAT, did pretty well, and ended up getting into a decent law school. There he learned useful skills, skills that would allow him to earn a living in the village, and to court the women of that village. But what the man came to find soon after graduation was that, in this particular village, there are many people with the same skills. Many, many people. Really hard to overstate how many lawyers there were in that village. Accordingly, despite the man's efforts, the local maidens were not overly impressed. And after all that schooling, the man was ashamed to admit the sad fact that he still did not know how to use a sword. But the man was fine with this, totally cool with it, did not feel inadequate whatsoever. He landed a job with a medium-sized firm. The pay was a bit below market, and the position wasn't exactly his first choice. Top three, maybe, top five-ish, somewhere in there. Nevertheless, again, the man could have done worse. Competently plying his trade afforded him a very livable existence, allowed him to enjoy the company of loved ones. His parents were both gone now, and his sister lived in another kingdom, on the other side of the sea. But it wasn't like he didn't have friends. He totally had friends. People he could call to get the occasional beer, catch a movie. It was just that, well, there were those nights. Nights when the moon was new and the sky was dark, and the hour before dawn stretched out before him, threatening never to end. On those endless nights, he would lie in his cottage alone, looking through the window up at the starless sky and wondering, was there a life for him out there in the world? Someone who would love him, or could learn to love him, or, at least, let herself be loved by him? He thought about enchanting some young lady, but he had no talent for magic, though it was not really an option. If he was going to find a fair maiden to marry him, he would have to do it the old-fashioned way. trick her into it. Kidding, no, he was going to have to find a woman with sufficiently low standards so as to give himself a fighting chance. He eventually found such a woman, the only daughter of the candlemaker, a girl whom everyone thought of as plain. Also sad, quite sad. Not until they had been married for many years would the man come to understand how sad she truly was. But the man was getting ahead of himself. For now the point was, the man knew he had to marry the candlemaker's daughter, because unlike everyone else in the village, including the candlemaker himself, the man could see one thing. The young lady was not plain at all. She simply possessed a very mild form of magic, which she used for the purpose of hiding her loveliness. The man told the girl that he knew her secret. She denied it, and he told her that he knew she would deny it. Of course she had to deny that she was, in actuality, the most fetching maiden in the village, maybe in the entire realm. The girl looked confused, her face flushed with embarrassment. She searched his eyes, trying to understand. Was the man teasing her? But the man did not smile. He seemed earnest, told her that he knew why she used her magic to hide her beauty. It was in order to protect herself. But for some reason he, and only he, could see through it. Now the girl started to cry, because surely the man was trying to humiliate her, wasn't he? But she saw that he remained earnest. And after a while she stopped crying, and her face, slick with tears, kissed the man softly on the lips. The man asked the candlemaker for his daughter's hand in marriage. Her father asked that the man slay a dragon to prove his devotion. Even though the man was in decent shape, totally respectable shape, especially considering that he didn't have time to go to the gym, he still wasn't strong enough to swing a two-handed broadsword. So, being nothing if not practical, he sought out the smallest dragon he could find. After a long search, he found one not much bigger than a wild fowl, possibly a baby. If we're being honest, the dragon looked sickly. It had scared, wet eyes, and as the man raised his sword above his head to slay it, his betrothed said to him, "Don't. Please. That's dumb. You don't need to kill a baby dragon just to prove something to me." "All right," the man said, barely hiding his relief. He lowered his sword, petted the young dragon on the head, and sent it back to the cave or wherever. The candlemaker was angry, or maybe not angry. He was a fairly gentle soul, but definitely miffed. Still, he wanted his daughter married off, so grudgingly, he gave his blessing. The man had found his wife. He said to her, "I will provide you with a good life." "Pretty good, at least." She said, "Quit talking and let's go, before my father changes his mind." And so they did, and the man loved his wife, to the extent that he knew how to love, anyway. The man had a clumsiness about him, in his hands, and in his heart. He fumbled words, missed chances, and, despite his best intentions, was prone to mishandling fragile things. Together, they shared a quiet existence that was defined by well-managed expectations. Perhaps not the stuff of legends, not quite deserving of once upon a time, but it was comfortable and honest. He wondered aloud if this was really worth his and the therapist's time. But the man was coming to understand that his therapist was not going to let him out of this exercise until he had navigated his way along one, an emotionally honest path to, two, an unexpected, three, yet inevitable destination. Whatever that meant. The man sighed loudly and continued. "Once upon a time, there was a guy who couldn't swing a sword and nearly peed his pants whenever he saw even a toddler-sized dragon. So he went to law school, where he learned a bunch of very useful skills. And when he graduated, he became a lawyer, and he was pretty okay at that. And it allowed him to build a life, try to build a life." Great. The therapist liked where this was going. But he had dreams of more. He told his wife this as they lay in their cold stone hut at night. "Oh," she said, hopeful, a little surprised. "What do you dream of? Being a hero?" "No," he said sheepishly. Deep down in his heart, what he dreamed of was not to be a lawyer or a hero, but a blacksmith. A silly dream, he knew, so he had never told anyone. He waited for her to laugh, but she didn't. She said that it was a lovely thing to dream of. But having said this, the man was already talking himself out of it. Blacksmithing was old-fashioned, and hardly anyone actually made a living at it anymore. He would, of course, keep his job as a lawyer, would always provide for her, and the candlemaker's daughter said, "I know you will." It was cold, so they spooned, made love under the nearly empty night sky. Through the window, the man saw a single star. It hung low, twinkling at them. This was kind of how they did things for a while. Talked at night, made love, and then the man would fall asleep, and his wife would listen to him snore and worry about him. He seemed tired, overworked. She would worry well past the witching hour and, at some point, drift off into her own restless half-sleep just before dawn. She had anxiety and took potions for it, and herbs, and other things from the apothecary. All of it was prescription. It wasn't like she was self-medicating or anything. But the potions didn't help, or maybe helped a little. They caused her to have spells of forgetfulness, to lose an hour here or there. But nothing really could lessen her dread. It turned out that she was right to feel dread. One night, in the very short time during which both she and her husband were asleep, a sorceress from far away, whom they didn't know, put a spell on their home for some reason they would never understand. They would not ever be blessed with the gift of a child. That one star hung in the sky, and it would never fall to earth for them. The couple handled this news in different ways. The candlemaker's daughter did research, read books about it, found a local support group that met on Tuesdays. The man, unsure of what to say, tried not to talk about it, stopped blacksmithing for a while, started grinding his teeth at night. A distance grew between them. The man wanted to touch his wife, to be with her, but it hurt too much. Still, they loved each other. After work one day, the man came home with two bottles of good wine, and they opened both bottles and sat on the floor in the middle of the living room, in their hut, and drank all the wine and ate an entire loaf of hard bread and laughed at each other and at themselves. Tried to see the silver lining in being cursed by a malevolent force. And in the morning, when they woke up, they felt a little better. They made a list. There was always adoption, which took time and money and patience and luck. But they were in no rush, were they? Plus, while they waited, they could enjoy each other. Take more vacations. If they could save up enough copper coins, maybe even go all the way to the seashore. Eventually, why not? They were staying glass half full about it all. And then, out of nowhere, boom, just like that. Just when the man had given up, you know? One day the star did fall from the sky into the belly of the man's wife, and there it burned for 6 weeks until it had a heartbeat. At 12 weeks, they told family, friends. At 18 weeks, they found out it would be a boy, their boy, and the lawyer blacksmith and the candlemaker's daughter were overjoyed. They didn't want to question why it had happened now, or whether it had anything to do with them finally letting go. They just thanked the heavens and the earth and whatever little magic might be left in the world. It wasn't the easiest pregnancy. There were nights when the invisible wolf, carried along by the fire wind, would come and snatch at the child with its jaws, try to take it away and carry it back into the hills. The wolf came at 30 weeks. At 32 weeks it came again, and the sage elder mages were worried and had the man's wife spend the night, just for observation, just a precaution. Fortune was smiling, though, and they made it to 35 weeks. The mages still had concerns. They looked into their crystal balls or whatever. Behind closed doors, they talked in hushed tones. They nodded their sage heads sagely, stroked their beards, gave the lawyer blacksmith grim and ponderous looks. Ugh, the mages were really kind of awful about the whole thing. So when the child was finally born, the man and his wife wept with joy and relief. Two arms and two legs. Two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. Color in his cheeks. Head covered with wisps of soft, almost invisible hair. It was a few weeks later that the man's wife first noticed it. Something about their baby. Difficult to see at first, because the boy looked fine. He acted fine, nursed, slept. For the first 2 months, the blacksmith and his wife would frequently stop what they were doing, pause, and look at each other, as if to say, "We did it. 6 months in, they didn't look at each other anymore. Instead, each of them silently studied their boy, afraid to say anything to the other lest they make it real by uttering out into the world what was, day by day, increasingly hard to ignore, saying only generally positive things, vague expressions of hope. No reason to worry yet. Don't jump to any conclusions. At 12 months, they said nothing. There was no need to say anything. The man and his wife took the boy back to the mage, who had brought him into the world. At first, the old wizard refused to see them. He shook his head gently. The man's wife begged, fell to her knees, and pleaded. The lawyer blacksmith tried to pull her up by the arms, but she wouldn't move. She cried there in front of the mage's tower for 3 brutally hot days and 3 painfully cold nights, the man watching over her the whole time. On the morning of the 4th day, the mage emerged on his way to somewhere else and was alarmed and scared as he stumbled over the candlemaker's daughter, still waiting there. He could not let this go on any longer. "Your son," he said, "he will never be of this world." Now the man's wife broke down with fresh tears. The man stared at the mage and said, "What do you mean? What does that mean? I know you're a mage and that's how you talk, but you can't say something like that and then just stand there." "The boy's spirit," the mage explained, "what some might call his soul, it is trapped. You can think of it as being inside a small box, and that box is inside another box, and that box in another, and so on." "Is this because of the curse?" "Could be. Hard to say. It is possible that the child is afraid to come into the world, or that he is not fully allowed to, owing to the persistent dark energy that was attached to his creation." Dark energy. At this phrase, the man's skin turned cold. He feared, he knew, something in him had caused all of this. He had no way of proving it, but the man knew it was his fault. Could not even look at his wife, afraid that just one look and she would instantly understand. But if his wife did have any such thoughts, she did not betray them. She took the man's hand in hers and pressed the mage for options. What could they do? Tell us what to do. "The answer," the mage said, "may be hidden deep within him, too deep to retrieve safely. You will never know him, but you will care for him, love him, see that he is everything a child needs." As soon as the lawyer blacksmith heard these words, he knew that they were true. He wondered what insurance would cover. He worried about the large deductible, the high cap on out-of-pocket expenses. Ahead of him, the lawyer blacksmith saw many years of therapists, of special schools, of helpers. No birthday parties, no playdates or friends, no playing baseball with his son. At 16 months, the boy stood up once, clapped his hands. At 20 months, a word. "Bye. Bye-bye. Bye." Then at 2 years, more words, all in rapid succession. "Mama, baby, da, sorry." Why sorry? Maybe he heard it often. At 3, he said, "What's that? And who's that? And where are we going?" When he was 5, the lawyer blacksmith's son said, "Dad is my best friend." He said this from very far away, from a place deep inside himself. The man could barely hear his son. The boy was sitting on the ground and looked confused, and from his mouth came a terrible sound, an old sound, a pain trapped in there. The boy looked out the window at other boys running. He wanted to run, but his legs wouldn't work right. His father said, "They do work, son. Your legs are just fine." And the son said, then, "Why do I feel stuck?" His father said, "We will get you unstuck. Those are nice legs, good legs. Don't be mad at your legs. Look at me. Look at mommy. We will figure this out. We gave you those legs. We are sorry. I am sorry, but it is not your fault. And you will get to run." The boy eventually did run, sort of. It looked funny. And other boys laughed at him, so after a few tries, the boy stopped running. Was the man okay? Did he need a moment? The man was fine. A glass of water, perhaps? No, the man said, "I'm fine." Deep breath, okay? In other ways, things were going pretty well. As it turned out, the man did have a talent for blacksmithing. Not a great talent. He would not make swords for knights and princes. But he had something, and people noticed. They started to bring him stuff to smith, and he could smith the heck out of that stuff. He hammered stuff and flattened other stuff and made stuff, stuck stuff in the fire and stuff. What had started out as a thing on the side turned into a little bit of a cottage industry. He had time to do this because he had quit his job at the firm and now worked as a lawyer in local government. No bonus, but good benefits, and the hours were so much better. Now the man was home most nights for dinner. He and his wife and son moved to a slightly bigger cottage just outside the village. The lawyer blacksmith was still no knight or lord, of course, but he could provide for his family. They were never hungry. Things were fine, mostly, although sometimes, when they went down to the village for a harvest festival, other families would look at them, and they hated the way they were looked at. Sympathy mixed with something else. Something like, "I admire you, but don't touch me, or I might catch a plague of misfortune." Sympathy, as in, "I sympathize, my heart goes outward to you." Outward to you as in, "You, over there, stay over there, don't come any closer, I will admire you from a distance." The man knew that look well. The man's wife said, "Don't be so hard on people. They mean well." But the man said, "Meaning well is for shit." Oh, he knew that look, and how he hated that look, the presumptuousness of it. Those other families didn't say anything. That was the worst part. Except when they did say something, and that was even worse. "So inspiring, you must be so strong, selfless." Now that was a fairy tale, the idea of selfless people. As if their lives were somehow different. As if they didn't have flaws and urges, didn't ever want to have a couple of drinks or three or 10. As if having a kid like theirs made them into some kind of charmed species, some imaginary fairy tale type of non-human humans. People who never got bored or tired or horny. But the blacksmith lawyer, as much as he resented these strangers with their heartfelt looks, couldn't blame them, so he ignored them. He was up for a promotion to managing attorney of his department. By now his son was 8, no, closer to 10, now 15. The years were getting away from him. The boy still had no friends, and though it hurt the man every time his son asked why not, it hurt more on the day that his son stopped asking. That was years ago now. Things were still fine. The cottage felt small, so they bought another one. Not great timing, because a month later, the blacksmith lawyer was passed over for the better job. Something about his not having the right attitude. He'd heard back-channel whispers throughout the village that the higher-ups in the department all liked him, but they wondered if he could commit to the additional responsibility, given, well, his circumstances. They knew he had a kid at home who required extra care. That was all maybe a nice way for them to not say what the problem really was. Maybe that they found it kind of depressing to be around him. They all felt for him, though. His lovely wife, his special needs kid, or whatever. They would never fire him, he knew. He could have a job there for as long as he wanted, doing land surveys on local fiefdoms, dividing up the realm for lesser lords and vassals, assessing taxes on men far richer than he could ever dream of being, drawing a steady stream of copper into his accounts. A stable life, a life for his family. That was the right thing to do. So he did it. He was angry at his wife, even though she had never asked him to do it. He began staying out late, for work at first, and then not for work. His wife made ever more frequent trips to the apothecary, began to learn the trade. Soon she had perfected a potion of her own, an elixir for relaxation, she called it, just to get through the day. Their son continued to grow. His body did, anyway. The rest of him, it was harder to tell. At times, he seemed like a soul trapped inside a mind, trapped inside a brain, trapped inside a body. A body that turned into a man's body while somewhere in there, flitting around like a moth, without any direction or understanding, was a child, a baby. Their baby. Fuck, man, do I have to do this? I don't know if I can keep doing this. Keep going. This is good. What's good? The therapist said that this was serious progress. The man was finally getting somewhere. The man didn't know what else to say. His armpits were sweaty, his back hurt, his ass was sore from the therapist's lumpy couch. He had to take a piss. He was tired of narrating. Okay, then, he could have a break, drink some water, and then, whenever he was ready, start again. The man didn't want to start again, but the therapist cast a meaningful gaze at the clock and the man understood that his time was almost up, and so he started again. Once upon a time, there was a therapist who had no idea what she was doing. The man waited for a reaction, but the therapist didn't take the bait. She didn't say anything. She nodded and leaned forward and waited for him to continue. Once upon a time, there was a therapist who wasn't going to do any good and cost too much, and it's not like the man was made of money. He did all right, but this was not exactly in the budget, and anyway, they weren't the kind of people who hired therapists. That was for rich people. It was his wife's idea, soon to be ex-wife, maybe. And what kind of crap was this, imposing conditions on him to save his marriage? Like he deserved this. After all he had done, conditions. Conditions. Like he was the only one who was broken. Like he was the only one who had maybe got a little too angry at the kid. The man-child. Never violent. But just a little mean. But goddammit, he didn't know where the meanness came from. He couldn't help it, really, when it started rising up in him. The blood and heat climbing into his face. And he could feel it. He was going to say something that he couldn't take back. He was going to say something that was the opposite of what he wanted to say. When all he wanted to do was stroke the boy's cheek and say, "Sorry. Shit, sorry. I'm all over the place." "It's okay. Take a moment. Take as long as you need." "I don't know." "What don't you know?" "I don't know if I can do this." "Have a sip of water." The man took a sip of ice-cold water. Once upon a time, there was an angry guy who hated the story he was in, all right? He was angry, okay? Once upon a time, there was a guy who wasn't allowed to start a story with once upon a time because it wasn't once upon a time, it was a specific time. And he wasn't a blacksmith, he was just a regular guy who lived in the forest. He waited maybe too long to get married, but the thing was, he had his mom to take care of. Never felt it was time, all those years, watching her body shrivel up. His mom, who deserved better. He worked days, and at night he looked after her, and then, when she was gone, he got married. A little later in life, maybe too late. But he'd wanted his own story, just a simple one. That was all he and his wife wanted. And the OBGYN told them about the elevated risks, the witch's curse and all that. But whatever, they had the boy anyway. The man and his wife and the boy who laughed and clapped, but didn't talk or run. It was a family, his family. His wife, she was good. She was a better person than he was. She showed him how to love the boy. He loved the hell out of the boy. And they moved even deeper into the forest. They wanted to be far from everything else. They didn't want to see other people anymore. Wanted to find another forest, another village, another once upon a time where they'd be safe from potions and spells and anything else. Dragons, werewolves, curses. A place without magic. Wherever that might be. The guy and his wife built their house to be strong, fortifying it with wood, sticks, mud, stones, whatever they could find. They lived carefully, quietly, didn't even look at each other most days. They'd had enough of living in a half-assed fairy tale. Enough bloodshed, enough potions and elixirs, enough of that for a lifetime. They figured if they didn't talk, didn't try to understand it at all, then the story would just go away, would stop trying to mean something. Would stop trying to break their broken hearts. So they stopped thinking. At night, they stopped dreaming. From their heads, they carved out the parts that had made dreams and fed them to wild animals, scattered their dream stuff on the ground to be pecked at, gnawed at, chewed up, waking, sleeping without dreams, working. Like this, they passed many days. Years. The boy grew, but he didn't, really. Then one day the man looked at his wife across the breakfast table. She was putting a strawberry into their son's mouth. Their son was smiling, dumb, unknowing. A grown man's face with the eyes of a child. The smile of an idiot. This was the most beautiful thing the man had ever seen. For a moment he was happy. He went out to gather wood, and in his happiness, walked much farther from his home than he had in a long time. He came upon a stream over which there had once been a bridge, whose wooden planks had now rotted away. And there he discovered a curious sight. On the other side of the ruined bridge, sitting there alone, was his son. "What are you doing out here?" he asked. "How did you get here?" The boy said he didn't know. He started to moan, a horrid sound, a grown man crying like a baby. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm so sorry." "Okay," the man said. "Okay, don't cry. Tell me, sorry for what, little dude? What are you sorry for?" "For all the trouble, for messing up your life." "Oh God," the man said, "no." The man was the one who should apologize. How could he possibly explain that he wasn't strong enough or good enough to be the boy's father? The boy said that he was trapped, wasn't he? Trapped over here on this side of the bridge. He started to cry again. From across the distance, the man tried to soothe his son, hummed to him, a song from when he was a baby. The boy stopped sobbing for a moment long enough to say, "Dad, tell me a story." But what kind of story could the man tell? The man wasn't a good enough storyteller. He'd had a kind of allegorical thing going for him once, but he'd lost the trail. No map, no legend. He no longer knew what stood for what. He looked around. He was in the darkest part of the forest. He didn't know this area, the cottage, the clearing in the woods. It was all so small and so far from everything. The sounds coming from the trees were frightening. The man realized now what he had done. He had tried to ignore the story. He and his wife had tried to go on with their days, not speaking or thinking too hard. But the story had never gone away. Neglect and time had done their work. While the man wasn't looking, this place had fallen apart. He turned to see where he had come from and saw that the trail back to the cottage led nowhere. A few yards from him, it just sort of faded into the surroundings. Behind him, no way to retrace his steps. In front of him, a bridge to his son that had long since rotted. If he tried to cross, it wouldn't hold his weight. He couldn't get from here to there. So, instead, he turned away from both, away from home and from his son, and he just ran. He ran as fast as he could, flat out running through the unknown forest. And then his wife was running beside him, and every ghoul, every beast, every horrible thing, corporeal, immaterial, everything that had ever hunted or haunted the man and the woman was now right behind them, pressing. And leading them all was their son asking, "Don't you want to be my parents? Why not? Why not?" Soon they couldn't remember if they'd ever done anything but run. Their lives had been one long chase. "No," the man said, "this isn't fair." And his wife said, "We have no time for fair." And the man said, "Why are we running? We're in our own story. We don't have to run." Then he looked down at his body and he saw that he was not a hero, not a blacksmith, or anything else. He looked over at his wife and saw that she was not a damsel in distress, not a candlemaker's daughter. He barely knew her anymore. But he knew that she was Rachel. She was whoever was inside of Rachel. She was the mother of their child, their boy. He looked at the boy. A grown-up man now, still a boy. A lovable boy trapped inside a smelly man. And he knew that he would wipe the boy's nose and ass and anything else for as long as he needed to. Because that's what blacksmiths do. That's what fairy tale heroes do. They become government lawyers. They buy groceries. They shave their son 3 times a week and feed him pudding and sing to him once in a while. This was not a dream, not a fairy tale. This was all there was, all there would be. Once upon a time there was a fable, and maybe at one point things corresponded one for one, or close enough. But somewhere along the way, it had twisted, and now he wasn't sure what it was. The man was out of ideas. He heard the clock ticking. Tick, 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 tick. He looked at his therapist, wondering if he was already over time. The therapist didn't say anything. The man understood that he was in a new territory. He'd reached the edge of the forest. There was nowhere left to run. He took a breath, realized that he was still sweating. Was this what the therapist had wanted? A lawyer blacksmith in her office, sweating all over her couch, slowly losing his grip? Did she know how to help him? Could she help him remember how to get from here to there? "Time's up," she said. "It's a start." "A start?" "Yes." The man looked at his therapist, wondering if she could possibly be serious. His lunch hour was over. The man got up to leave. On his way out the door, he said, "See you next week." And the therapist said, "Maybe." He turned to look at her. She said, "Let's see where you go from here." The man went down the hall, relieved himself, washed his hands, splashed water on his face. As he stepped back out into the hallway, that was when he saw it. It looked like, come on, no way. He was just seeing things now. But could it be? And the carpet, the faintest outline, a trail. Where did it lead? Was it a way out or a way in? And the man said to himself, "All right then, maybe she's right. If this is where your story starts, then so be it."
That was Charles Yu reading his story, Fable. His story collection, Sorry, Please, Thank You, was published by Pantheon in 2012. He's currently working on his next novel, The Book of Wishing. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. If you enjoyed this program, you may also enjoy the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which features New Yorker fiction writers reading and discussing stories from the magazine's archive. This month, Dana Spiota reads and discusses Chicken Hill by Joy Williams. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.